We'll be looking at a passage from John chapter 6 this morning. We've spent the last few weeks talking about the journey, and so we're gonna be talking a little bit about that this morning, and about how difficult a journey is when it gets hard. When I was in high school, and I went to a very small school. We had 25 people on the football team on a good year. And, so a lot of times you'd play offense and defense. And so our coaches came up with this philosophy, and that philosophy was, it didn't matter if you knew how to play football, if you got tired in the first quarter. So starting in August, we would practice, and our first 2 or 3 weeks of practice, we wouldn't even touch a football. And, I remember one particular night, I think the coach's plan was to run us until the last guy vomited, which took one guy especially long time. It's very frustrating to the rest of us. But it was, and you guys know August around here, it's a little warm and a little humid. And if you think it's humid in Greenville, I suggest you move to the swamp. In Washington County, the humidity is significantly higher than in Greenville. So a good August afternoon around 5, 6 o'clock, 96 degrees, 95% humidity, and you're in shoulder pads and a helmet, and you're running, and you're running. And I remember years later I was talking to our coach. I ran into him somewhere, and we were talking. I said, "Why'd you do that? Why'd you try to kill us?" And he said that, the only way to have a good football team was to have guys who wanted to play bad enough to endure the hard part. And he said, when you have a team full of people that have never been challenged and never had to endure difficulty, you don't have a team. He said, and you find out what kind of team you have when the heat index is 110 and you're sick and the coach keeps you running. Now, I didn't enjoy that. I kind of laugh now because coaches aren't allowed to do that kind of stuff now, because the first time some guy throws up, the nurse is out there going, "You can't make him run anymore." By the way, we didn't have a nurse. We had an EMT who doubled as the ag teacher. And Mr. Melton, who was a legend in Crestwell, in fact, I saw his daughter last night. I hadn't seen her in 30 years, but saw her when we were down there yesterday. Yeah, I remember coming to the sideline sick as a dog. I just throw it up. And I came to the sideline, and I sat down, and he walked over to me. The EMT walked over and said, "Here, drink this." And I was like, "Oh, what is this?" He said, "Gatorade. And get back out there." So that's the kind of TLC we got in high school. When you look at the church today, and you look at how people visualize relationship with God, and we think about how people view church and Christianity and relationship, and we think about what we expect from it, it's generally connected to positive things, good things. And if it gets hard, if it gets difficult, people's inclination is to say, "Well, I don't need this. This is not what I signed up for." How many of you have ever gotten involved in something, and once you got involved with it, you thought, "This is not what I signed up for"? In fact, everybody in this room probably at some point has done that. When I do premarital counseling, I try to let people know, "What do you think marriage is?" And then they'll tell you, and then you go, "Yeah, that's not what it is." And I've had couples that have told me, you know, "That's not what I signed up for." I'm like, "Yeah, you actually kind of signed up for everything when you got married. That's in the fine print. You signed up for everything." Did I? Remember that thing, that line, "For better, for worse, for richer, for poorer, sickness and health"? Oh, yeah. I said, that's what you were saying. Oh, it's always fascinating when people realize that they said that and they didn't mean it. So when we think about Christianity and how the world views Christianity today and some of the tenets of Christianity and how unaccepted they are and unpopular they are, and understanding that this is not a new concept. So we're going to go back to John chapter 6. We're going to start in verse 60. Now, what's happening here is Jesus has just recently fed the 4,000. And now these people who he fed are following him. And he has this massive crowd of, the text calls them disciples. These people are following Jesus. And so we pick up in verse 60. So it says, therefore many of his disciples, and let me kind of sum this up. Jesus starts talking about the Lord's Supper. And he starts talking about, unless you eat of my body and drink of my blood, you have no part in my ministry. And that was a very unpopular thing to tell people. It says, therefore, many of his disciples, when they heard this, said, this is a difficult statement. Who can listen to it? But Jesus, conscious that his disciples grumbled at this, said to them, does this cause you to stumble? Now, when I'm always fascinated with this kind of passage, because Jesus here is essentially purposely telling a group of followers some stuff that's going to be incredibly unpopular. It's going to be incredibly unpopular. And he says this, and when people are bothered by it, he asks them, does this cause you to stumble? How many of you know someone who would probably be a Christian if the rules were different? I would guess that most of us know somebody who would probably sign up for Christianity if the rules were different. How many of you think Christianity has a bad stigma about the fact that you can't, life just all of a sudden becomes unlivable if you're a Christian? Any of you know anyone like that? I think I shared this with you guys once before, but some of you probably weren't listening. When I used to be on a committee at the hospital, and one of the people on the committee was a lawyer. And about my third or fourth meeting, somebody mentioned that I was a minister. And he goes, no way. I don't know why I get that reaction. And I said, yeah, I said, why are you so surprised? He said, well, all the ministers I've always known, when they walk in a room, they suck the fun right out of it. He said, but you seem to have a good time even in these meetings. And I was like, well, yeah. But his stigma, his vision of Christianity was, if you were a Christian, you were signing up for a life of misery and where you couldn't have any fun and nothing was funny. You couldn't laugh at stuff, you know, and you just, it was, I think he kind of pictured that old Dark Ages vision of the monk who's walking around hitting himself in the head. You know, that was his vision of Christianity. I think a lot of us probably know people like that that think, well, you know, if I was a Christian, I couldn't do this and I couldn't do this and the rules are too strict and I'm not allowed to do this. And there is some truth to that. So Jesus here, he looks at these people and he says, this thing I've just told you, does this cause you to stumble? Is this thing I've just told you, is this a problem for you? Now, one of the things that is really troubling about the state of the church today is that we have a lot of people who are part of, and I'm using big quotation marks here, the church, who have chosen to take an entirely new approach to Christianity, which I call the Burger King church mentality, which is, I can have it my way. I will subscribe to the things that I like. I will ignore the things that I don't like. And I will add the things that I think should be there that aren't. Now, take a minute and ask, if I could create my own religion, what parts of the Bible would I leave out of it? Some of you are going, that tithing thing, that's got to go. There should be a rule that says that I don't have to go to church, ever. I can be a Christian from my couch. We would call that, when I was in college, by the way, if someone slept in on Sunday and didn't go to church, the joke was they had attended Bedside Baptist. And not we didn't say Baptist just because we were trying to knock on the Baptist, but just because Bedside and Baptist both start with a B. And I guess if you stayed on your couch, it could be Couch Church of Christ, but Bedside Baptist had a better ring to it. And I'll tell you, when I was in Bible college, we actually had students who attended Bedside Baptist on a fairly regular basis. And you kind of wonder, why would a Bible college kid not go to church? Well, when you go to chapel four times a week and you're spending 18 hours a week in Bible classes, it's pretty easy to reckon, I don't need to go Sunday. That's another hour I don't need. I'm going to chapel four times a week. It's like revival every week at Bible college. So I don't have to go Sunday morning. So you had people who kind of bought into that mentality. Not a lot of them, but there were a few. I did not. Just throw that out there. Except once. It was once. But I was not feeling well. So when we kind of think about, man, I like Christianity, but I don't like this. And I like most Christianity, but I don't like this teaching and this thing, that whole forgiveness thing. There are people I don't want to forgive and I'm not going to forgive. I don't care what the Bible says. I'm not going to forgive them. I know Jesus said I'm supposed to forgive everybody, but I'm not going to forgive this person. I'm sure he'll understand, which by the way, he won't. Because he forgave people when he was hanging on the cross and he forgave the people who put him there. So he's probably not going to understand why you can't forgive people when he did. But the concept is pretty simple. It's like Jesus says, look, I've taught you all these things and you're not going to like them. And by the way, after all these years of teaching, after 3 years of teaching, how many people did Jesus have on Pentecost that were still disciples? About 120. Those are not real good numbers. For 3 years of doing miracles and all the stuff he did, his numbers had dwindled because his teachings were not always simple. So it says that Jesus looked at these people and said, is this a stumbling block? Does this cause you to stumble? Do you not like this teaching? Now, if we can go to the next slide. So it says, as a result of this, many of his disciples withdrew and were not walking with him anymore. So because of the difficulty of the teaching, a lot of people just bailed out. They just bailed out. Now, I want you to think about this, and just because we're kind of in a new year theme, I just want you to think about this coming year. What would be the circumstance this year that you might say, as a result of this, you as a disciple withdrew and were not walking with him anymore? Now, the reason I ask that question is every year there are people in the church who are Christians in January who are not active Christians in December. It happens every year. So the question for you as people sitting here today is, what would be the circumstance this year? What in your mind can you think of that would happen this year that would make you go from being a disciple to withdrawing from Christ and not being a disciple? Now, when I do premarital counseling, one of the questions I ask couples every time is I'll sit down and I'll get them in the room and we'll get them side by side and I'll say, do either one of you ever planned to not be married to each other? By the way, in all the years of counseling, I don't think I've ever had a couple go, no, we expect to be divorced in 5 years. I never had that happen. Which is ironic because I've had some whose marriage lasted less time than the counseling. So it's like when they say that, because nobody's ever planning on getting divorced, when they answer that question, here's the next question I'll ask them. What would it take for you to get divorced? That's the next question. And then there's a lot of deep thought. And they begin to articulate what could happen in that marriage that would make them separate. So the question for you today is, what would it take this year in your life to make you as a disciple, assuming that you are a disciple today, what would it take to happen this year that would motivate you as a disciple to say, I don't want to be a disciple anymore. I don't want to do this anymore.
Can I ask a question, please?
Yeah, sure, why not? Right. Nothing. Well, that is a paraphrase to be certain. But I think what you're going to, nothing can separate us from the love of God. Is that the Paul passage in Romans? What can separate us from the love of God? Not height nor depth. Yeah. Right. If there is a separation between us and God, it's because we chose it. Okay. But that's what the question is. What this year would happen that would cause you to choose that? Now, as you sit here, most of you are probably like those couples that sit on my couch. As you're sitting there thinking, you're going, oh, well, I can't think of anything. I can't think of anything. Okay. How many of you have ever been angry at God for something? Well, that's a pretty decent number. I have. I think most of us probably at some point have been unhappy or disgruntled with something that happened, either that we think he caused or something we think he could have prevented, but we go, I don't know why this had to happen, and it doesn't seem to be rectifying itself the way I think it should, and I'm really not happy about it. And for some of us, that's not enough to separate us from God, because we make our peace with it and we move on, because we understand that being a Christian doesn't mean we always get our way. So we do that, but there are circumstances, and I guarantee you some of you are in some sort of relationship, whether it's a professional relationship or a family relationship, but I guarantee you that there are people in this room who have connection to people who used to be disciples who are not anymore. Any of you think, can you just think of anybody that's like, oh yeah, I know somebody like that. They used to be. But they're not anymore. And the question becomes, well, why not? What happened? What happened? What was the circumstance? What was the circumstance that led a person who was once a disciple to now not be one? And so in this particular text, John records, he said, as a result of Jesus' teaching, many of these disciples withdrew and they decided not to walk with him anymore. And so as we look at that question, as we answer that question, well what could happen? There's some startling statistics. I throw this out for our high school kids who are rapidly approaching college. And parents, you should pay very careful attention to what I'm getting ready to say. If you don't listen to anything else I say today, I suggest you hear this. It is documented that close to 80% of church attending teenagers drop out of church while in 4 years of secular college. 80%. And according to some, that's a low estimate. So for you high school kids who are sitting here today and you're hearing that question going, well, what would make me not want to be a disciple in a year? Some of you may very well have to answer that question in the next year. I went to college and things changed. Things changed. You know, at the beginning of January, things between me and God were good. But by December, I don't go to church anymore. Well, why'd you stop going to church? I don't know. How many of you have ever lost interest in something because you got busy with something else? Yeah. How many of you ever lost interest in something because you got mad about something? I remember my dad going one time to visit somebody who was a member of the church, and they had stopped coming. And so he went to visit them. Because that's what he used to do. He went to visit them. You didn't show up at church for a few weeks, he was going to be at your house. And so he sat down with them and said, "I haven't seen you in church in a while." So now, "I'm not coming back." "Well, why not?" I'm mad. He got mad about something. I don't even remember what it was. Doesn't even really matter. But he was mad, so he stopped coming to church. And Dad said, "Were you going somewhere else?" He goes, "Nope, not going to church anymore." And Dad said, "Well, you do realize that if you break fellowship with Christ, you understand what the eternal ramifications are of that." He goes, "I do." And Dad said, "So let me make sure I understand what you're saying. You got mad about something at church, and your plan is to go to hell to spite the church." "Well, preacher, I wouldn't put it like that." And Dad said, "Well, maybe you should. That's your plan. That's your master plan. I'm going to go to hell to spite the church." By the way, if any of you come to that conclusion this year, that I'll show them I'm going to break my relationship with God and that'll fix them, I just want you to know, I'll miss you in heaven. But I'm still going to go without you. I just go ahead and throw that out there. And by the way, I guess most people in this church would be the same mindset. I don't know anybody in this church who go, "Well, if they're not going, I'm not going." I just want to tell you right now, ain't nobody in this room loves you enough to go to hell with you. At least I don't. If you do, maybe you should come see me. We'll talk some after church. I love a lot of you. I like some of you. I love all of you. I don't love any of you that much. I'm not going to go to hell with you. But there are people who do that. And so when we start thinking about this year, and as our relationship with God moves forward, we start thinking, what can separate us from the love of God? And Jesus says, "Hey, there's this teaching, and it's hard, and you may not like it." And they said, "Well, because of this teaching, some of them decide not to walk with him anymore." Any of you ever been reading a verse in the Bible and you thought, "Ooh, that's tough. I've never seen that before." Is forgiveness tough? Yeah, it can be real tough. Loving your enemies? Tough? Yeah. How about when the Bible teaches things that are not wholly accepted culturally in our culture today? And we kind of stand out because we have a set of beliefs that seem outdated. Any of you ever felt like your belief system was outdated? I've been in some situations where I've had to talk on faith in front of some fairly hostile audiences. And fine. I had somebody come up to me after I spoke at the homosexuality and Christianity thing that they did at ECU, and I had a young lady come up to me afterwards, and she said, "Can I ask you a question?" And I said, "Sure." She said, "Do you feel guilty at all being in front of this audience saying what you said?" And I went, "No." She said, "Not even a little bit." I said, "Nah, not really." She said, "You don't feel guilty at all." I said, "I'd feel guiltier if I hadn't said it." I said, "I'd feel guiltier if I hadn't said it." I said, "You know, the fact is the Bible says what it says. I don't get to pick and choose that. The Bible says what it says. I share it with you in love. I don't hate you. I'm not mad at you. My job is to say what it says. You interpret it any way you want to, but my job is to teach it the way what it says. I've tried to do that here for 21 years, to teach what it says best as I can. And there have been times in this room that I've said stuff that some of you are like, I don't like that a bit. I try to say what it says. Sometimes as Christians, the things it says is going to put us at odds with people in the world. Sometimes it's going to put us at odds with people in other churches. It's okay. It's all right. You don't have to be hateful. Don't have to not love them. but speak the truth in love. Jesus says, look, there's some things that I teach that may be hard, and because of them, some people choose not to walk with me anymore. But in verse 67, it says, so Jesus then looks to the 12, his boys. And he says, you do not want to go away also, do you? I've always found that to be a fascinating thing that Jesus does here. Now, the Bible doesn't tell us how many of the disciples left. The fact that there were disciples, that it identifies there were disciples who left, means I think there may have been some people who had been with him since the beginning who were not the 12 who left him, who abandoned him at that point. And so Jesus looks at those guys, he says, you going to leave me too? How many of you have ever felt abandoned by others? You know, it's like, oh, am I the only one now? There's a great passage in the Old Testament, and I've preached on this before, but it's been a long time, but there's a passage where one of the prophets, Elisha's walking through the wilderness, and he's just recently smote the prophets of Baal. But now, just not long after that, they're chasing him down, trying to kill him. All the other prophets have been killed, and he's out there by himself. And any of you remember what he says to God? He says, I'm going to lay down right here. Remember what he said? I just want to die. I just want to lay down here and die. I'm the only one. I'm the only one left. I just want to lay down here and die. That there is a real frustration when we feel like we're doing the right thing and we're following God, and our expectation is, if I follow God and I do the things I'm supposed to do, what's supposed to happen? Great things supposed to happen, right? When I was a young minister and stupid, I had this really simplistic concept of church. And it was real simple. If you got up on Sunday and you preached the truth, what would your building look like? It'd be full. I just used to think it was that simple. You get up, if you had a good sermon, you preach the truth and you share the gospel with people, that the room would be full every week. Well, one of two things must be true. Either I am an awful preacher who does not tell the truth, or preaching the truth doesn't fill up a room. One of those two things, and maybe both of them. But the fact is that we have an expectation sometimes that if we just do the right thing, what's going to happen? Good things are going to happen, right? That's what televangelists tell us. If we just are faithful and we do the right stuff, everything's just going to line up perfect, right? Let me ask you, has your life experience told you that that's the way it works? No? Peter did all the right things, right? What happened to him? Crucified in Rome. Paul did all the right things. What happened to Paul? Beheaded in Rome. James did the right things, beheaded in Jerusalem. John the Baptist, he did all the right things, beheaded in Jerusalem. If you wanted to whip out Fox's Book of Martyrs today and you could read what happened to all the original 12 disciples as they went all over the world preaching the gospel and doing the right things, and every one of them met a violent and painful end for doing the right things. So Jesus here has gotten up and he's preached the word of his Father. He's done what he's supposed to do, and people are abandoning him in droves. And he looks at his guys and he goes, what about Dylan? You going to leave me too? Caleb? Colin? You guys going to bail on me too? You got me. Thanks, man. Appreciate that. Not raising your allowance. just. Catherine, you going to bail on me too? Hazel's like, yes. No, I'm just kidding. Oh, yeah. Anybody in this room, hey, you're a disciple of Jesus. If things don't go your way this year, if things get hard, if there's some teachings that become complicated and difficult, and if forgiveness of somebody that you don't want to forgive becomes required of you, and if culture begins to close in on your belief system and you begin to feel pressured to not follow what Christ taught, if those things happen in 2020, Jesus wants to know, are you going to bail on me too? Are you going to abandon me? Are you going to do like so many of my churches that have turned their back on what I teach so that you can still be popular and relevant, so that you can still matter to people, so that you can be popular and culturally accepted? The code word for that today is inclusive. We want our church to be inclusive. Let me tell you something about the church. It's never been inclusive. It's always been exclusive. It's only been for people who are willing to accept Christ and his teachings as is. Now, that's not a popular thing to say because that sounds awful. By the way, let me tell you someplace else that's exclusive. Heaven. Heaven is exclusive. You know who it's exclusive for? His people. And you may say, well, I don't know if I like the way you're phrasing that. That's okay. You stand there on the day of judgment and see the number of people who get in versus the number of people who don't get in. And then you can find me in heaven or yell at me across the wall and go, hey, you were right. This place is exclusive. This is a gated neighborhood and hard to get into. Jesus says the road to heaven is what? That's narrow. The path to destruction, that thing's wide. That's an interstate, baby. One of them eight laners that runs through Atlanta. I'm not saying Atlanta's hell, by the way. Don't get me wrong. I'm also not saying it's not. I'm not saying. But it's a wide lane road that runs to hell. Jesus said the road to heaven is narrow. Okay? So when we look at what Jesus is challenging us with, he says, look, I got some hard teachings. I've always had hard teachings. He says, look, my yoke is easy, my burden is light, but my teachings are my teachings. They're unchanging, and you need to get on board with them. And when it gets tough to follow my teachings, are you going to bail on me? And so he asked the 12 that. And then, again, classic Peter. Who else could answer this question but Peter? In verse 68, it says, Simon Peter answered him, Lord, to who will we go? Who else will we go to? You have the words of eternal life. We have believed and have come to know that you are the Holy One of God. So where else will we go? You know, it's funny. People will turn to all sorts of things to try to find salvation, right? They'll turn to humanism. They'll turn to secularism. If you've ever listened to any of Ravi Zacharias's apologetics lectures, he has a fundamental thing whenever he's debating atheists. He says atheism at its core can never work because atheism lacks morality. There is no morality in atheism. Now, for those of you who are going, well, I don't know, how does that work? Keep in mind that if there is no God, if there is no supreme lawgiver, there's no supreme law. There is no good and evil if there's no God. Now, imagine a world where there's no good or evil. Everything is subjective, right? Everything is lawful based on what the majority says is lawful. So the Holocaust, okay. Right? Do you realize that in the 20th century, which saw the rise of atheism and humanism in a period like we've never seen before, do you realize that the 20th century was the bloodiest century in world history? Did you know that? And let me just tell you, for those of you who think Adolf Hitler was a really, really awful guy, let me tell you something about Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler is not in the top five of people who slaughtered other people in the 20th century. He's not even in the top five. Mao Zedong in China, we don't even have a count. It was in the millions. Stalin in the Soviet Union, confirmed 20 million he killed. Pol Pot, any of you remember that name? He was in Thailand. Was he Thailand? Where? Cambodia. Cambodia. Some estimates put upwards of 15 million he killed. I mean, Adolf Hitler's 7 million, that's not even, that's minor league. And this was all 20th century, the era of human enlightenment. Humanism and atheism, we became an enlightened culture in the 20th century. We killed more people in that century. In fact, we killed people more people in the 20th century than the previous 19 centuries combined. Let that sink in for a minute. And so we look at God's laws and his teachings, and we look at them and go, well, humanity's got a better idea. Humanity has a better understanding. We can come up with a better set of laws. Really? History says not so much. So God says, these are my teachings, these are my laws, these things are absolutes. I have put these things in place for your benefit. And sometimes they're inconvenient to us. Sometimes they're difficult for us. They're challenging. When God says you need to practice forgiveness, then we go, well, he didn't mean that. Yeah, he did. When he said you have to love your enemies, well, not all my enemies. Yeah, he meant that too. When he put these things in place, he put them in place for a reason. And we see in the book of John, as people have just exited him in vast numbers, he looks at his people and he goes, guys, what about you? And Peter's answer is just beautiful in its simplicity. Where am I going to go? Where am I going to go? He says, where else are we going to turn? We have believed and have now come to know that you are the Holy One of God. That there are going to be circumstances this year which are going to make you question your faith. I don't say that because I'm a prophet. I don't say that because I'm a skeptic. I say that because Satan is going to do that. Because Satan wants nothing more than to push you and shove you and prod you and goad you and try to move you away from God. He's going to do that. Because that's what he does. And it's not like he can try to convince you that hell's a better place to be than heaven, because that would be bad. It's simple marketing. How does Satan try to separate people from God? He tries to make the walk with God not seem worth it. And on that day, literally, thousands of people walked away from Jesus because they didn't like his teaching. They didn't like the rule. Throughout the early church, there were people who wrestled with Judaism versus Christianity because they didn't like the new rules. They didn't like them. This has always been a struggle for people of faith. My challenge to you today is to understand that in this coming year, Satan is going to give you reasons to abandon God. He's going to put obstacles in your path. He's going to put frustrations in your path. He's going to put anger and animosity and confusion. He's going to do whatever he can. Social barriers, cultural barriers, issues at work, complications at church. There are going to be 100 reasons this year for you, if you choose to turn your back and walk away from God. As thousands before you have done. So my question to you today is, what can separate you from the love of God in 2020? What is it that could make you be one of these people who at some point, because things got hard, turned and walked away? I hope it's nothing. But history tells us that that may not be the case. We need to be vigilant in our relationship with God. We need to be aware of Satan and what he's trying to do to manipulate and move us, to poke us and prod us so that we can stand up to those attacks and stay firm in our relationship with Christ. We're going to stand and sing our hymn of invitation this morning. I want to challenge you to be vigilant as Satan is constantly moving to push you away from Christ as we sing our hymn of invitation this morning.